Argument this morning is Castellano versus Walmart. Mr. Sanders?
Thank you, Ron. You know, I started beginning to prepare this argument. I was trying to figure out how to get this thing down to 15 minutes, as I'm sure a lot of litigants do.
Well, you're saying by one thing, I've already had the briefs, so, you know.
Yes, sir. I'm going to begin. There's so many errors in this case, that's the problem, to knowing which ones to address. I'm going to begin by pointing out one of my errors. In my brief on page 4, in the statement of facts, it makes a comment that Walmart had sold this building to Lancaster Trust back in the beginning of the, after the building was built. That is an error. It should have been that the Castellanos sold that building. Walmart was, in fact, the landlord and did not have the ability to sell it. So I'm just going to correct one of my errors. Your Honor, as you see in the brief, this case was dismissed on a Rule 50 directed verdict approximately 2 hours into the trial. This was scheduled for a 4-day trial, and 2 hours into the testimony, the judge stopped it, decided to have a directed verdict, and in his final order or with his discussions with counsel, pointed to absolutely no testimony that occurred during that 2 hours that would have changed the complexion of this case. This complaint was amended 4 times. There were 4 different motions to dismiss directed at it. There were 2 summary judgments over a period of 3 years, and throughout all those motions, counts 1, 2, and the 2 breach counts and the fraud count always survived. And what occurred during that 2 hours to cause the judge to, in the middle of testimony, issue a directed verdict really is totally beyond me. Count 1 of this was a breach of contract claim alleging that the 3rd Amendment to the lease was valid. The whole crux of the problem with that was the language in the amendment that states, as when received, Walmart had a duty to return this building to the condition it was in upon termination as when received. Our allegations are that as when received means when Walmart took physical possession of this building, which was in 1979. The term as when received was used in the original lease when it was signed in 1977. This was a pre-construction lease. Walmart never argued that they had a duty to tear the building down under the original terms of the lease, but if you interpret that term as when received the way Judge Frazier did, they would have had to tear the building down because when they signed the lease in 1977, there was no building on the premises. Judge Frazier has taken the position that as when received means as when they signed the lease or as when they signed the amendment. This is exactly the same language in the amendment that was in the original lease. And the judge states in his final order, and I'm reading directly from page 19 of my appendix, was his final order, said those terms cannot reasonably be interpreted as an agreement that upon termination, Walmart would return the structure of the roof to the condition existing before the building was damaged by the tornado, end quote. With all due respect to Judge Frazier, I don't see how a reasonable person could interpret it any differently. You're talking about the exact same language, dealing with the exact same lease, with the exact same landlord, on the exact same building. The language means exactly in 1987 what it meant in 1977, that they had a duty to return the building back to the condition it was in when they took possession of the building. And that is the crux of count one. That is what it was dismissed because of. Count two was also a breach of contract claim filed in the alternative to count one, and alleges that the 3rd Amendment to the lease was invalid. This is based upon the fact that the leases, or rather this building, contained mortgages, 2 mortgages, and both mortgages had requirements in them stating that they were doing an assignment of leases and assignment of rent, and these leases, or this lease with Walmart, was part of the security of the mortgagee. Neither Walmart nor the landlords had the authority to modify that lease without the approval of the mortgagee. And it stated that in their assignment of rents and in their mortgage. These mortgages were recorded. So it is our position, and we cite to a Supreme Court case on this matter in our brief, that if Walmart had knowledge, either constructive or actual, which in this case they had both, if they had knowledge that the landlord did not have the legal capacity to by themselves amend this lease, they cannot reasonably rely on the landlord's signature to making that third amendment valid. It simply did not contain all the requisite signatures to make the amendment valid. It was missing two of them. We suspect that is the very reason that Walmart never bothered to record the third amendment to the lease. The original lease was recorded, the two subsequent or two prior amendments were recorded, the third amendment was never recorded. So we're simply saying that as a matter of law, the third amendment cannot be enforceable because it does not contain all the requisite signatures and approvals. And Walmart knew that. The last count that we're asking, or the last situation we're asking that this court to reverse, concerns the fraud count. This case involved two settlement agreements or partial settlement agreements after the case was filed. One agreement was reached in October of 1998, and Walmart claims that that agreement was superseded by an agreement in March of the following year. In October of 98, the attorney for Walmart sent to the attorney of the plaintiff what we say is an offer, that they said, we will not require you to rebuild a wall. We will give you a building that belongs to us if you don't make us build a wall back in between the two buildings that we have. The discussions at the trial, on the day of trial, with Judge Frazier, when he decided to dismiss the fraud count, almost totally centered on whether or not I could prove damages on my fraud claim. He went on for 15 minutes, and it probably encompasses 20 pages of the transcript on the question of damages. However, when he drafted his final order, he completely abandoned that argument and went in favor of one particular issue. And he stated, and this is on page 20 of my appendix, I quote, the evidence would not demonstrate that the attorneys who exchanged correspondence in October 1998 had the litigants' express authority to settle their claims, end quote. I have no idea where Judge Frazier gets this. This had been discussed several times through the 3 years of this case, and the problem is evidence had been submitted to him in some prior proceedings on motions by Walmart in pretrial documents showing that their corporate representative had terminated direct negotiations with the landlord and told them all future negotiations would have to be through their lawyer. In addition, the settlement letter, or what we're claiming was a settlement offer letter sent by Walmart's attorney in October 98, clearly states, and I quote, I have been authorized to advise that my client stands ready to XYZ, and he spells out the terms. So he clearly says that he's been authorized to do this. This letter is contained on page 35 of my appendix. This issue went back all the way to December of 2002 during a pretrial conference, and I'm reading from page 15 of the transcript of the pretrial conference that existed on December 11, 2002. On this very issue, Judge Frazier stated back then, at that point, he said, well, just as a matter of simplicity here, what's wrong with simple agency? I mean, isn't Walmart kind of stuck with what Mr. Mitchell says? That is the exact position that we had been taking all along. He was Walmart's agent. Walmart had told our people, you need to deal with our lawyer. And Judge Frazier agreed with that in December of 2002. However, I don't know where the tide turned on that one, because in March the 31st, 2003, at the final pretrial, he was still curious about this issue, apparently, because during the discussions, he asked Mr. Niehoff, and I'm reading from page 25 and 26 of that transcript, it says, and we've probably been over this already, did Bruce Mitchell, did he have the actual authority of Walmart to extend any, and at that point, Mr. Niehoff cut him off and answered a half a dozen other questions, but never said yes or no, he did or did not have the actual authority. And it really wouldn't have mattered what the attorney would have told the judge at pretrial, because this is an unsworn statement. It would have been hearsay by the attorney. They needed to put the attorneys on the stand and ask them those questions. And we had, in fact, noticed up both attorneys, subpoenaed Walmart's attorney, to testify. We never got the opportunity. Judge Frazier cut us off before we ever got a chance to put the attorneys on the witness stand to testify. This was an oral agreement. The March agreement was completely oral. The attorneys had discussed it over the phone. The attorney for Mr. Ed Renshaw, who was attorney for my client at the time, sent a letter memorializing what he thought the major terms to be were. Walmart never responded. They never said, yes, but you left this out, or we agree totally, or whatever. The only way to know what the terms of that March agreement were to put the attorneys on the stand and have them testify. We never got the opportunity to do that.
What's Illinois law say about the express attorney, Mr. Sanders, of an attorney in this situation?
Your Honor, there's some flux on that. And the question is whether or not, I think in this case, I don't believe the actual authority is what's necessary. The problem is Walmart had made assertions to the plaintiff giving apparent authority. When they told the plaintiff, you have to deal with our attorney. We're not discussing this with you anymore.
Yeah, but that kind of a comment, I guess, is not uncommon in commercial transactions where you may have principals involved in negotiations, but say at some point, maybe when you're approaching a settlement, you say you have to deal with my attorney because you're speaking generally to formalizing terms, I would gather. So can we take from that you have to speak with my attorney? Is a command that we can read express authority into that?
I don't think it necessarily goes to express authority. I do think it goes to implied authority. There are various cases on this issue in Illinois, and some of them simply say that if there is implied authority and the other person relies on that, then if the lawyer screws up, then it's going to be between Walmart and Bruce Mitchell. Their remedy, if he cost them money, would be to sue the lawyer for malpractice if he went beyond the scope. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is because there's no way the other side can know, because of the attorney-client privilege, what the attorney has been authorized to do. The real problem that's created
well,
here...
Did the Castellanos have an ownership interest in the property at that point? With this settlement that you say...
The Castellanos did not have an ownership interest in the building Walmart owned. That's what the discussions were about. Walmart owned one building... We owned the other, and there was no wall in between them. Walmart was discussing deeding us their building in return for not putting back the wall.
So what would you suggest is we should look to as what would be the potential damages to the Castellanos in that situation?
On the fraud count?
Yes.
Your Honor, I believe what we've got here is actually two claims overlapping. I believe the claim would be loss to rent during that time, because had Walmart turned that deed over, my client could have immediately rented the building out. He was not able to do so for several months. So I believe we'd probably be entitled to recover under a theory of breach of contract and fraud, and they would be offsetting damages. But I think both theories work in that particular situation. The problem that we have here is that the fact that the original summary judgment order that Judge Frazier issued in April of 17, 2001, I believe it was, states, and this is on page 7 of my appendix, the written communication between the parties show that Walmart reached an agreement. He's referring to October. He comes back later and says there's no way they had an agreement. They didn't have authority to have an agreement. He had already ruled that they had an agreement. So we had rulings in this case that were all over the place. One would contradict the other, and he'd come back and he'd say something completely different. So that's where our problem is. We think it just needs to be thrown out and started over.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sanders. Mr. Niehoff?
My name is Bill Niehoff. I'm here on behalf of Walmart. Thank you for taking the time this morning. I believe this case has been made more complicated than it should be. I believe Judge Frazier did an admirable job with the facts and the various legal theories that were put forth to him, and came up with the right result a little later than we would have preferred, perhaps, but he got there nonetheless. Couple of points that Your Honor's addressed, or that Mr. Sanders addressed in his direct argument. I believe Judge Frazier did cite to Illinois law as what the authority of an attorney is to settle a case, and we believe that to be an accurate statement. Your Honor, Judge Flom pointed out that Marion Castellano, with respect to the fraud count, as we pointed out in our brief, did not have an ownership interest in the building at the time the alleged misrepresentations were made to him. In fact, his son, J.D. Castellano, was the sole beneficiary of the land trust at that time. We had a real issue with standing. We raised that in the brief, and I believe it's been addressed. The third point that was addressed was with respect to damages, and Mr. Sanders indicated that the fraud count led to damages for lost rent from the period of time after Walmart moved out of the building until it was sold ultimately, or 7 months. And we believe that the settlement that was achieved in March of 1999 addressed the issue of the wall. That was the reason that the complaint stated that the building was not leasable, was could not be released with the absence of a wall dividing two buildings. When that issue was resolved, Walmart's building transferred to Mr. Castellano's interest at that time. That took care of the damages. That was part of the consideration for that settlement having been made. As I said, Your Honor, I have struggled at times with how to simplify this case, how to make this understandable, how to evaluate this in terms of existing Illinois precedent, given some of the nature of the claims made. We think that this is essentially a lease dispute between Walmart and the landlord. There are problems with some of the wrongdoings that were alleged in various legal defenses that have led to some I think, unique legal arguments being made, in particular with respect to the roof. In 1982, this building suffered severe damage, and due to a tornado, Walmart, there's no question this has been stipulated to, Walmart arranged for the construction and the repair of the building, including the roof and roof structures. That occurred in 1982. As I said, this...
Who paid for that?
Not a record. Walmart's insurance company ultimately paid for that, I believe.
So it's not the landlord?
No, it was not, from my understanding, Your Honor. Walmart had put the roof back on or had arranged to do that. They arranged contractors in order to get the store back up and running and operating as soon as possible, and that was done. The lawsuit was filed more than 20 years or 20 years after that act. We believe the statute, the improvements to real property statute proposed, would bar any claim with respect to the quality and nature of the repairs being made in 1982. The landlord at that time was fully aware that Walmart was repairing the building. Castellanos at that time were not the landlords. However, they owned property in the same shopping center. Their buildings were damaged. They watched the construction going on. They had access to the building. There's been no surprise, not that it would make any difference anyway, with respect to the statute of repose. We think all the issues with respect to the roof are governed by contract that the original lease agreement put the obligation on the lessor at all times to maintain the roof and roof structures. The Third Amendment to the lease executed in 1987 contained a similar requirement, and so the lessor at all times, not Walmart, had the obligation to maintain the roof and roof structures, even including those for defects in construction or defects in materials. That's expressly in the language. This is the second time this particular building has been before this court, by the way. In 1980s, litigation existed between J.D. Castellano and Walmart with the third party involved in that. As a result of some of that litigation, the Third Amendment to the lease agreement was entered into between the landlord and Walmart at that time. Mr. Castellano has stepped into the shoes of the landlord. We believe it's frivolous for him to argue that he's not bound by that agreement that his predecessor interest executed and which both parties performed under for over 11 years prior to this lawsuit being filed. There was a settlement, Judge. I think that in my terms of analyzing this case and trying to reduce the red herrings, the false issues, I looked at all the claims that were brought, filtered them through the settlement that was achieved in March of 1999. There's no question that there was a settlement reached between Walmart and between Marion Castellano March 8th, at least it was the letter summarizing its terms was dated March 8th, 1999. That letter, drafted by the attorney for Marion Castellano, reserved only three claims. Those related to the roof construction, which we've addressed in our brief and in argument here today as to why those are barred. The second is for rent, and again, at that point in time, plaintiff's position was that Walmart had breached the lease by moving out due to the leaky roof and owed rent for the remaining period of the lease. I think we've set forth adequately in our brief the condition of the roof Judge Frazier was absolutely right when he found that that was a material condition that rendered the store uninhabitable and allowed Walmart to terminate the lease in accordance with paragraph 16B of that document. The third item that was reserved by that settlement was some issues with respect to the carpet and flooring, which has been eliminated from this case. As I said, the settlement agreement was we took the depositions, and this was presented in connection with the summary judgment motions. The plaintiff's attorney, Ed Renshaw, said he believed it was a valid and enforceable settlement. The plaintiff himself, Marion Castellano, so testified. Walmart testified as well, relied on it, transferred the building, which was approximately 25,000 square foot, to Mr. Castellano, and he in turn sold that, rented it, obtained payment for that from his buyer.
Did Renshaw negotiate this settlement?
He did. Yeah, I believe he did. I believe that he, in fact, there was correspondence in the file that indicated, of course, he discussed those terms with his client, Marion Castellano, and that was approved. As I said, Marion Castellano admitted that in his deposition, that he had agreed with the settlement in its entirety, so had no reason to challenge it. Starting from that point, we look at the rent claim again. Walmart's, you know, justifiably terminated the lease. Any obligation to pay rent ended. With respect to the roof, it was the landlord's obligation at all times and to take care of that, and also the statute of proposed statute of limitations bars that. We think that the procedure using a Rule 50 motion at trial, unusual, I will grant that. I think it was appropriate in this case. When we got to trial, we'd had a series of motions in limine directed to preventing plaintiff from raising issues such as economic duress, which had been ruled on previously. The testimony in the first hours of the trial repeatedly detoured into these areas that had been ruled on, requiring us to object, and I believe, you know, creating a difficult atmosphere with the jury, threatening our ability to have a fair trial. What Judge Frazier did during the extensive, and I mean extensive argument, several hours worth following the clearing of the jury and on this motion for directed verdict, was to explore with plaintiffs in detail what their obligations, what their proof would be. And in the course of that, counsel for the plaintiff indicated that his proof of fraud was these two letters. Those two letters did not even rise to the level of an enforceable agreement. In October of 1998, had there been an enforceable agreement created by the letter from Bruce Mitchell and the supposed acceptance by Ed Renshaw, Marion Castellano, they could have gone to the trial court and enforced that agreement. They did not.
Did the October 30th letter, are they terming that the acceptance?
I believe so, Your Honor, yes. And there are terms in there. Of course, we disagree with that characterization. There's additional terms added in that acceptance. It says it's agreeable. There's not a yes, we'll take it kind of a statement. And if there were, the remedy at that point in time would have been to go to court and say, Judge Frazier, these guys have made a settlement agreement. We need to have this enforced. It would have been easy to do. They didn't do that, even though counsel and plaintiff discussed that very idea. Instead, they continued negotiating and concluded a settlement in March of 1999 that resolved all of these issues. The contract issue was particularly appropriate to resolution by Judge Frazier as a matter of law. We believe the law is that contract interpretation is a matter that is a matter of law to be decided by the judge. We believe there's no other conclusion that can be drawn from reviewing these documents other than the responsibility and obligation for the repairs, maintenance of the roof were contractually allocated to the landlord. Marion Castellano stepped into the shoes of the landlord, and he is bound thereby. Were there any other questions? Judge Fulham, you look like you had something.
No, apparently not.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Mr. Sanders?
Just a couple of quick points, Your Honors. First of all, there is a question on the original lease whether the landlord had a duty to keep this roof under repair. Section 23 of that lease gives Walmart the right to make alterations and modifications to the building, but would require the tenant to bear all costs associated therewith. Walmart terminated its lease because of leaks in the roof, and all the leaks were contained in the portion of the roof that Walmart had altered. And this was a serious design change in the way this portion of the roof was built. So it's our position that under Section 23 of the lease, if Walmart materially altered the design of the building, they had all to bear all the costs associated, including the maintenance costs on that. In addition, the claim has always been made that
Walmart owned the building?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Did Walmart own the building?
No, Walmart was leasing the building.
Were they paying, they're paying rent?
They were paying rent for a while.
And the landlord's saying that, well, that roof is their problem?
No, the lease says that if they make an alteration, in other words, if they modify the building, they have to bear all costs of the modification.
Okay.
I see my time is up here. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. Mr. Seahawk. The